Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, Chris Massini's guest is Spokane poet and mixed media artist Catherine Smith, celebrating the release of her new poetry collection. I'll catch up with Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture Executive Director Wes Jessup, who also has reason to celebrate as he announces a partial reopening of the museum and the arrival of a jolly good new exhibit. Nathan Weinbender reviews a curious film, 1983's never finished, never released Grizzly 2. Music is from a live piano bench program this week that featured the music of American composer Philip Glass, played by North Idaho pianist Melody Puller. This is Northwest Arts Review.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini. My guest today is Catherine Smith, a poet and mixed media artist based here in Spokane. She's the author of the poetry collection Book of Exodus and the chapbook Chosen Companions of the Goblin. Her newest collection, Self-Portrait with Cephalopod, won Copper Nickel's 2019 Jake Adam York Prize and will be released by Milkweed Editions on February 9th. When Catherine will be hosting a virtual release party with Auntie's Bookstore. Catherine Smith, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Chris. It's good to be here.
So first of all, congratulations on your new book. And I want to just marvel for a moment at how cool it is that this is the second year in a row that a Spokane poet has won this prestigious poetry book award. So Brooke Mattson, her book In Accelerated Silence, won the same award last year. So what do you think that says about our poetry scene here in Spokane?
Yeah, it was pretty crazy to find out that I had won the same prize that Brooke had won the year before. But I think it just goes to show that we have a lot of really talented writers here. And I have felt that way for a long time. And I think that the rest of the world is starting to catch on.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be that way. So would you be willing to read a poem for us to kick us off?
Sure. This is called Meditation Among the Fragments. Some mornings, I skirt the shoreline, weaving with the tide, my pockets heavy with rocks and shells, ancient litter, evidence of a life lived at the edges of things. Some pieces are only ever broken, bone pores gritted with mica, wave-smoothed rift and algal stain. This sand dollar fragment chips from its star whorl, vulnerable there, where beauty meets function meets beauty. I press a hand against my own center, feel the seam where waves could crack me. In such a vast, calcifying tumbler, who could keep what's necessary? I let silt and silver wash through my foothold, finger the grit. Let the tide, as it will, draw in.
That was my guest, Catherine Smith, reading a poem from her new collection, Self-Portrait with Cephalopod. So as the title in that poem suggests, there's a lot of ocean imagery in this collection. And I wonder, as someone who lives, mm-hmm. 300 miles from the nearest ocean, where does that influence come from? How did that find its way into your work?
Yeah, well, I grew up on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State in the town of Port Angeles, and there are a lot of poems in this collection that reflect on my childhood or on growing up or on going back to visit a place after not living there. You know, we always have different relationships with the places we're from later in life, so there's some reflection on that, and I didn't really necessarily realize how deeply that the ocean and tidal imagery affected me until I started putting this collection together and realized how deeply embedded it was in all of the poems.
The other thing that I think is sort of a unifying theme with these poems that I noticed was there's a world that these poems inhabit that is a pretty dark one. It's like smoke-choked skies and car wrecks and plagues. In other words, it's the world that we live in. And and particularly, I know that you wrote a lot of these poems, actually all of these poems, before this year, but they seemed particularly resident in 2020, or the year that we've just gone through. So I wonder what you think of, you know, how does capturing some of those more difficult or trying experiences in poetry help us face them sort of in the real world?
Well, I guess one thing it says is that for better or for worse, we're always facing difficulty. We're always facing disasters. and we somehow find ways to push through. You know, there are references like to the plague in this book. And I was thinking of, you know, like the plague, like the bubonic plague or the black plague. And, but thinking we're living through this pandemic that in many ways feels like a modern day plague. So I guess part of my hope is that even if the poems were written with a particular time in mind or a particular scenario, that they carry resonance in other situations that we live through.
Yeah, well, I mean, I very much had that reaction reading this book. You know, it feels like it could have been written in 2020, even though I know it was written before, which I think is just a hallmark of good poetry, that it's resonant in whatever time you're reading it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking with Kathryn Smith. Her new collection of poems is titled Self-Portrait with Cephalopod. It'll be out February 9th. So many of these poems are in direct conversation or in response to other Spokane area poets, namely Maya Zeller, Ellen Welker, Laura Reed. So tell me about the Inland Jellyfish Collective, as it's called in the acknowledgments.
Yeah, you know, that's we've sort of been jokingly referring to ourselves as that for some time. And I was like, can I make this official? Can I put it in my book? Yeah. So we refer to ourselves as the Inland Jellyfish Collective. You know, these are poets who inspire me and hold me up with their poetry and with their friendship. And yeah, I think having a community of poets to work with, to share the difficulties and the joys of trying to be this sort of an artist has been really valuable for me. And yeah, I'm excited because they're going to be part of the book release with me. They're going to read some poems as well.
Oh, great. Well, why don't we end with one more poem from your collection? Is there another one you'd like to read for us?
Sure. I will read the title poem. And this poem is actually dedicated to Maya Zeller. Self-portrait with cephalopod and digitalis purpurea. Sometimes a girl doesn't need a reason to place a foxglove blossom on her tongue. It's enough to like the idea that the heart could stop because of flowers. It's that or be crushed like ichthyosaurus in a kraken's grasp by my own sadness, fossilized in unnatural linear patterns, finally measured by the geometry of loss. I don't need another reason to fear the ocean. I already know it could swallow me from the inside if I tried to breathe it in. Everything beautiful is dangerous, and attempting beauty is a risk, like the dress my mom's friend made me for the eighth grade dance. So often things don't hang together the way I imagine. That seafoam bow over my pale, scant breasts looked nothing like the pattern promised. It made my head hurt, knowing how little meets our expectations. So I refused the last dance, and my date left without me. He spent the next 4 years pretending I wasn't there, my shadow scuttling the halls of the high school beside him. Sometimes a girl doesn't need a reason to want to disappear behind the unseen framework of collarbones. I think mine would look lovely in a cephalopod's garden, after she had spit away the sateen straps. Have you ever wondered what's beneath the skin, working? I know so little, I wouldn't recognize my own heart if I saw it outside my body. I wouldn't know my own bones arranged in an ocean bed, an octopus coaxing them to root in the sea floor until their stalks grew thick with mouse-like blooms.
That was Catherine Smith reading the title poem from her collection, Self-Portrait with Cephalopod. She'll be hosting a virtual release party with Auntie's Bookstore on Tuesday, February 9th. You can find more information about that event at auntiesbooks.com. Catherine, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Chris.
Sometimes the most affecting music is made from the simplest materials. We found this out on Tuesday as the piano bench again welcomed Melody Puller for music and conversation around a set of etudes by American composer Philip Glass. Here's a sample of what we heard and discussed. Glass's Etude No. 9. Music of Philip Glass, played in our KPBX studio by Melody Puller. And now for something a bit weird. Grizzly 2 was supposed to be released in 1983, a killer bear movie featuring a young George Clooney and set at a music festival in Budapest. But it was never completed until now. Nathan Weinbender looks at a long-lost B-movie curiosity given a new and totally bizarre lease on life.
Any time a movie becomes impossible to see, whether it's destroyed in a fire like Lon Chaney in London After Midnight, or locked away in a vault like Jerry Lewis's The Day the Clown Cried, it only makes me wish I could see it more. Grizzly 2 is one of those movies, an unfinished animal attack thriller I've heard about for years due to its turbulent production history and its cast of future stars. The film's original producer has now gone back to put the missing pieces of the puzzle in place and released the cobbled-together curiosity, now titled Grizzly 2 Revenge, and it's finally available on digital platforms. But first, a little backstory. Following the unparalleled success of Jaws in 1975, low-budget hucksters began strip-mining the least expensive elements of its premise to turn a profit. 1976's Grizzly was but a single droplet in the tsunami of Jaws ripoffs that swept drive-ins at the time, and it's basically an inelegant cover version of the Spielberg blockbuster, swapping the New England coast for the forests of Georgia and a great white shark for a giant bear. It became the most profitable independent film ever made up to that point, so of course it needed a sequel. Filmed in Budapest in 1983, Grizzly 2 hit production snags almost instantly, and because the mechanical bears broke down and the main financier ran off with all the money, most of the major special effects sequences were never shot. That explains the patchwork quality of Grizzly 2 Revenge, which begins with the kind of generic stock footage you might see running on a loop in a TV showroom. We see a hunter tromping through the woods before shooting a grizzly bear and its cubs, a moment that boasts some of the worst CGI effects I've ever seen. It isn't until much later in the movie that we learn the cubs were killed while the mother, now understandably ticked off, survived. The film then jarringly cuts to 1983 footage, wherein three backpackers played by young George Clooney, Laura Dern, and Charlie Sheen camp out in the woods and are promptly killed and eaten by the vengeful mama bear. From here, the plot concerns a music festival that's happening within this same national park, and the Nurse Ratched-esque park superintendent, played by Louise Fletcher, Nurse Ratched herself, who can't be bothered to postpone the event because of a few pesky bear attacks. Some park rangers decide to go rogue, hiring a French-Canadian fur trapper named Bouchard to solve their grisly problem. Bouchard, played by John Rhys-Davies, is the best thing in the movie. He speaks in the third person and really hates bears because, we're told, one killed his wife and children. Understandable. Alas, Grizzly 2 Revenge does not announce itself as a camp classic, but it's a bizarre case nonetheless. It's bad on a level I don't encounter often. This allegedly completed version still feels hilariously unfinished, though, with jarring edits and scenes that seemingly end in mid-sentence. The only reason the movie is coming out at all is original Grizzly 2 producer Suzanne Nagy, fulfilling a long-delayed passion project. It's certainly a noble pursuit, but I wonder if she came at this project with too much earnestness, taking something that was, arguably, already inept, and in attempting to fix it, made it even more inept. Over at the website The Ringer, there's an exhaustive behind-the-scenes account of Grizzly 2 by Brian Raftery, and it suggests there's a great documentary to be made of the movie's truly insane production woes. Until then, we have this strange object, the resurrected corpse of a long-dead movie that probably deserved a less public mercy killing. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Nathan Weinbender.
Nathan Weinbender is film and music editor for The Inlander, and one of the critics on Spokane Public Radio's Movies 101, heard Friday evenings at 6:30 here on KPBX. I'm Jim Tevenin, and this is Northwest Arts Review, also available as a podcast from SpokanePublicRadio.org. The COVID-19 pandemic has made for a rough road for many institutions, the Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture among them. The MAC's executive director, Wes Jessup, had some hopeful news, though, and I caught up with him this week.
Yeah, so the MAC was open for a brief period between late August and early November. We closed when the COVID case numbers began to rise in early November, and we were closed all the way through mid-January. We're open now, but in an extremely limited capacity. We can have families or people from the same household, up to six people from the same household every 30 or 40 minutes at the museum. So we are able to have a few people in. It's not that many, but I can assure you that if you're concerned about safety, it will just be you and people from your household if you're able to visit the museum. And in fact, we've been selling out all of the spots. And so there's definitely a desire for people to get back into the museum. You know, and we've seen that just in the last couple of weeks. It's a really great way to come down and see it with your family. Of course, we hope to be back to 25% when Eastern Washington region gets into phase two.
Sure.
But in the meantime, we'll be doing it this way.
This limited reopening coincides with a most elegant new traveling exhibit.
So we're actually changing out our exhibitions right now. Mm-hmm. We're opening a new exhibition, a main new exhibition in 2 weeks. And that will be an exhibition of the original costumes from Downton Abbey, paired with our Downton Abbey, the BBC, the very popular BBC television show from the period show from the early 20th century. And we will pair that exhibition with costumes from that same era in our own collection, in the Max collection. So we have an amazing, it's just an amazing display. And it, like I said, it'll open in 2 weeks. It's a complimentary show. So, you know, when we're thinking about exhibitions to bring, we like it when there's a local connection. When we brought Pompeii, it was on the 40th anniversary of the Mount St. Helens eruption. We happen to have a very large and extraordinary collection of clothing from the early 20th century, mostly bespoke, you know, tailored clothing from the families in Spokane came into the museum. So it's actually very much in sync with a lot of the same aesthetic approach that the costume designers were using. So it's a really interesting juxtaposition. Our costumes will be presented in the Campbell House, which will be reopening for the first time since last April. And then the Downton Abbey will be shown in the main gallery of the museum. I'd like to add that the installation and the design of the Downton Abbey display was worked out in conjunction with the Spokane Civic Theater. Their director, Jake, actually came and helped us design some of the quote-unquote sets for these costumes using the museum's collection and some of the props from Civic Theater. So we really are going to have a nice dramatic presentation of these costumes.
Well, it would be really nice to see the ones from the Mac collection in their native habitat, as it were, in the Campbell House.
Yes. That's exactly why we did that. I mean, this is the kind of setting where you would have seen people wearing clothes like that. Currently, we actually are open in our smaller galleries. We have two World War II exhibitions and another really cool exhibition that just opened that is that are paintings from a Japanese internment camp by an artist who went to an internment camp and when he was 50 years old, so sort of middle-aged, and documented his time there through paintings and watercolors and drawings. And it's a really great show. If you have any interest in the history of the internment camp program, this is a great exhibition to kind of see it through the eyes of an artist and to understand it maybe a little differently.
There's also a unique exhibit of Native American items opening soon as well.
There's one more small exhibition I'd like to mention, which is that the Mac is returning to the Tlingit tribe in southeastern Alaska 16 ceremonial objects that were, and we were responding to a claim of federal NAGPRA, Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act, which allows us to return those pieces to the tribe. And before those ceremonial pieces, they're quite stunning, go back in the summer, we've been given permission by the tribe, the Tlingit tribe in southeastern Alaska, to show these pieces. So we're going to actually have a small gallery devoted to these pieces. They're going back for good. And these were pieces that have been in the collection, some of them for decades. And so we're very excited about this exhibition, and we're excited that they allowed us to show these pieces. like I said, they're of ceremonial religious significance, which qualifies them for NAGPRA claims. So these will be going back, but they'll be on view this spring, opening in 2 weeks.
You say they're ceremonial. Are they items that would have been used in rituals of various kinds of the tribe?
Yes, they were. Yes, exactly. In ceremonial rituals, there are a couple of really amazing hats that were worn by the tribal chiefs. There's some ceremonial blankets. There's a pretty extraordinary box that was used for carrying different sacred objects and other things as well. And so it's an interesting exhibition. The MAC, you know, over the years has had a couple of repatriations, and so it doesn't happen very often. I think the last one was in 2008. So it's a big federal process that the museum went through, and we're just excited to be able to partner with this tribe in Alaska and get these objects back home.
It sounds like a really promising time, and let's hope that things do loosen up and that you can get back to the 25%, although this is a unique opportunity for you and your family to gather around and basically have a museum to yourself. That's pretty high concept there. I like that.
It's pretty great. I mean, of course, we would love to have more people coming, but we're just doing what we can during this time, and we're here for the community, and so we hope... we know we'll have a lot of people coming out to check out these new shows.
Wes Jessup, thank you so much for your time and all this information, and our best to you, and hope that we can all gather before too long at the Museum of Arts and Culture.
All right. Thank you very much. It was great talking.
Full information about the MAC's exhibits and how to access them is at their website, northwestmuseum.org. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Messini. We're grateful as well for the contributions of Catherine Smith, Wes Jessup, and Nathan Weinbender. Many and deep thanks to pianist and teacher Melody Puller for her generosity in sharing her time, talent, and the music of Philip Glass with us. We look forward to Melody's next visit to KPBX and the Piano Bench. For now, though, we go out with a bit more Philip Glass from this week's Piano Bench, from his Etude No. 3. Please do join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.